You're tuned in to the Vintage House Show, home to the original stories of the history of house music as told by the legends, pioneers, and icons. Hosted by Kevin Mega McFall, Lori Branch, and Lauren Lowry.
WNUR 89.3 FM and HD1, Evanston, Chicago. It's your main man, Mega, here for another episode of the Vintage House Show. Actually, this is my first for 2024, hoping to ensure that 2024 is a year that is full of prosperity, grace, and of course, house music all year long. I've got a very special show to kick off the new year, of course, and we're on the eve of course, Black History Month. We'll be doing some special coverage, getting in some guests who, of course, happen to be Black and celebrate the culture. As you know, house music is a creative force out of the African-American community here in Chicago. We are very proud of that fact. And we celebrate it here on every episode of the Vintage House Show. So you're tuned in to the right place if that's your thing. WNUR Street Beat, we're thrilled to host this program. But it's more than a program. It's always a special night in Evanston here at the WNUR studios. So let's get started. I am joined tonight by my guest, who has an incredible story to tell. I like to focus on the business of house music when I host. We've got such a great variety of people that tell stories about the music, the culture, the lifestyle. And like I said, I like to focus on the business because it is a business as much as it is a form of entertainment. And so tonight's guest has an interesting business perspective to share with you all. As you may know, and hopefully have tuned in for this very reason, tonight's guest, Louis Wes Green, is in studio with me to share his story about how he navigated getting appropriate credit for one of or several of Chicago and the world's most revered house songs. So without further ado, I'm going to bring him on board and have Louis join me here in studio, live on the Vintage House Show, Louis Green.
Hello, hello, hello.
Hello, Louis Green. I don't know that the rest of the world can hear you, but I can hear you.
Okay. I'll keep saying test, test, test until you get it together.
Test, test, test. Hello.
You are hot, sir.
I'm hot. Awesome.
But the people streaming our show tonight could certainly hear you. So everybody who's tuned in to hear the Louis Green story, welcome. And I welcome you and appreciate you as well. Louis, how are you tonight?
I'm great. I'm great, Kevin. How you doing?
Good. You are certainly no stranger to the WNUR studios. We've been honored to have you in studio helping get some of these stories out. But now tonight is your night to tell your story. And in fact, I know you've been doing a lot of work over the past few years, getting ready for the moment that you're living in right now. But I want to certainly start from the beginning and understand what your journey into the house music community was. Okay. How'd you get here today?
Well, I guess I got here like a lot of other, you know, young men and women growing up on the south side of Chicago. house is just like part of our DNA, right? So
no doubt.
You know, I went to a Catholic school, Catholic grammar school. Me and my friends, you know, we listened to house music. We grew up listening to it on the radio. You know, we were breakdancing before that. And it was funny. I remember I was at a party when I was young in grammar school, and we were breakdancing, and this guy couldn't beat me at breakdancing, and he started housing, and I just looked at him and shook my head and said, "Ah, I don't have nothing for that," you know. But that was kind of like one of my first introductions to house, like from a dancer perspective, you know. In grammar school, I was going to St. Dorothy's on 78th and Eberhardt, and
Southeast Side.
Yeah. And man, I just really fell in love with disco, you know. And I like the big band stuff, you know.
Charlie Colelo Orchestra.
You know, Salsa Orchestra, all of that. Like, I enjoyed all of that. And what I really enjoyed more than anything was the parties and the camaraderie, you know. So like, you could go to, I went to Mount Carmel, but you know, you can go to a Leo party, a Mount Carmel party. I never went to any Hyde Park parties, but racquetball club party, those were huge. Of course, all of the Catholic schools, because you know how they used to promote each Catholic school against another Catholic school, or this school against that school, to try to get everybody to come out. Which was, you know, genius.
Okay, I got to pause you right there. Okay. Because I went to St. Francis de Sales, and Mount Carmel and St. Francis had a bit of a rivalry. Not much from the St. Francis side, but pioneers stand up. Go ahead now. You can continue.
MC. Okay. So any of my Mount Carmel brothers out there, you know what I'm saying? We standing strong together. All right. So any case, yeah. So I just love the music. And, you know, I grew up on like 80th and Merrill. And I had a friend that used to live across the street from me, this guy named Timmy. Some people call him like Tim Beats Now, whatever. I think that's what they call him, his DJ name. But we started like DJing together. You know, and we started buying records together, and, you know, my dad would take me down to Import Records every weekend. You know, my mom and my dad were, like, separated or divorced, so, you know, I got to put the clamps on them on the weekend and make sure that, you know, he let me spend $20 or more every weekend to go buy some records. And so I go down to Imports, and Clarence used to be down there, like, man, every weekend he'd have records set aside for me, like, right away. He'd be like, man, you need these. And I'd be like, I haven't heard of that one. He'd be like, you need that. And I'd be like, and I get it home and I play it. I'd be like, oh, this is that track. This is that song, you know. And so that's how I started, you know, building my record collection and spinning on the SLB 100s. And
wait, belt drives?
Man, I didn't have no money for no high tech turntables. I mean, you know, a lot of DJs work would come up here and be like, I had 1200s, and I went, you know, to the music box, and I went here and I went there. Listen, I'm 52. I never went to the music box. I wanted to go to the music box. I had a good mom, so she wasn't letting me do all that. So
I'm gonna also give you some leeway and rope, because you're a little on the younger side. You're a young man.
I am. So I, you know, those are things I wanted to do, but it wasn't gonna happen. And I had like a belt drive turntable that my dad had, and then I had an SLB 100, and I had to try to make that stuff work.
Yeah,
you know, and
resourcefulness. I mean, that is big shoulders, big city of Chicago's whole vibe, right?
You
got to figure out how to make it work and do what it do.
And so then I moved to 70th and Chappelle. And there was like a, I think they still got that plaza up there now, like Jeffrey Plaza and all that. And they had like a little, what do you call it? 31 Flavors right on the corner where I live. And I used to enjoy going up there. So I had a neighbor because my mom had bought a 3-flat. And he knew this guy named Steve Poindexter. And so he introduced me to him one day and was like, man, you know, Steve be making tracks. And, you know, he's with Gucci Promotions. And I was like, oh, okay, cool, cool. Because, you know, I seen all the flyers and all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, we got cool. We started hanging out. And you're talking about a charismatic fellow. Man, like, that dude was charismatic. Like, he was, every time you saw him, he had a smile on his face. And, like, these big bright eyes and big smile. And, you know, and it was like, man. This is Mr. Gucci Promotions. You know what I'm saying?
Help me out with the time frame. Give me perspective on how old you were and how old Steve was at that time.
At that time, I was about 16. And okay. I don't know Steve's exact age. I think he was maybe about 20 at the time.
All right.
So, and it was cool because he, you know, get me into the parties and stuff like that. We hung out. You know, we used to go places together. And if you read one of my articles.
I did.
Like, I guess the 909 article, I kind of talked a little bit about that. But, like, you know, we'd be hanging out. Actually, back then, a lot of people had electronic stuff in their store windows. You know, when you would go past, like, what we used to call, it's not politically appropriate. We used to call them the Chinese shops, because they had all the electronic equipment.
Yeah, down, you know, downtown,
even in the neighborhood or whatever like that, you know.
South side.
And we had walked past one of these shops, and they had a Casio keyboard in the window. And it looked like a little toy. Like, it, you know, it didn't look like nothing you want to buy. Because back then, I wanted to buy the Insonic ESQ-1. You know, that was like a real keyboard.
But it was a sampler, right?
Right, it was a sampler. Yeah. I didn't have Insonic ESQ-1 money. But you know, you want what you want. You used to get the little magazines and see all the advertisements and all that. And so I looked at that keyboard. Steve was like, man, you should buy that keyboard, man. And I was like, man, that's not a keyboard. That's a toy. He said, nah. He said, any keyboard that don't have no speakers on it
is a
professional keyboard. And I was like, okay. So, you know, I'm like, he older than me, you know, all of that. He know what he's talking about. So I said, let me go ahead and save up my money. So I was working like at Mr. G's grocery store down there on 29th and Vernon, right across from Michael Reese Hospital, you know. I think they were paying me like $3 an hour or something like that. So I saved up my little change and went in there and bought the keyboard. And man, I was excited. You know, I was like, man, I got me a professional keyboard, right? Yeah. I brought it home, man. Unwrapped it. It had that new keyboard smell. You know what I'm saying? And, you know, I pulled out some cables and jury rigged to plug it into something. I put some headphones on.
So you get some amplification.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I get some amplification. I bought me some D-cell batteries and put them in there. And I started hitting the keys. And it was like, quack, quack, quack. Doop, doop, doop. I was like, what is this? This sucks.
Hear those.
Oh, my God. The sounds were laughable, you know.
Surely you still have this keyboard.
Right? I do have the keyboard.
Ah, yes. Okay.
The sounds were laughable. The
artifacts, so.
And so I was like, well, I done bought it now. So I said, well, maybe, you know, I can make some sounds. So I started, you know, it came with like a little manual. And they had extra sounds that you could program in from the manual. So I said, oh, man, I'm going to, you know, go through all these sounds in the manual. And I'm going to find me some good sounds. So I went through the manual, man. I programmed every sound in there for that manual. And they all sounded like the first ones that came standing with the keyboard, man. You talk about, like, it was crazy. But it was a MIDI keyboard, though. So that was the key.
Yes.
You could MIDI control that bad fella. You could, you know, use a MIDI.
Yeah.
Musical interface digital. Musical, was it?
There's two eyes in there.
Right. Musical.
One is interface.
Digital, musical instrument, digital interface.
There right. you go. Ding, ding, ding.
Right. So, I said, well, you know what? I can use these little riggedy sounds, but, you know, I have to figure out what to do. So, you know, Steve came by. We started, you know, messing around, and I went and bought a TR-505 and a Roland TR-505. And I bought that one because I didn't have money to buy like a 909 or 808, which is what I really wanted, right? But the TR-505 had like percussions, you know, everything. So timbales, you know what I'm saying, toms, nice clap, rim shot, all of that. So I was like, man, this is good because I get all of the basic sounds, you know, to make a track.
Enough to make a substantive right. Chicago yeah. house track.
Exactly. So I said, you know, I'm a use this. And then Steve was like, man, Wes, you know, I done seen them do it in the studio, man. You can set up your keyboard and your drum machine, and you can have the drum machine play the keyboard. I said, okay, cool. How do you do that? He said, I don't know. He said, but I done seen people do it. I was like, cool. So, you know, I just opened up the manual. You know, I was like, I'm going to figure this out. So I started reading the manual, and
reading
I figured
is
out how
fundamental.
To do it. Reading is fundamental. And I never forget, man. I believe it was, and I might be wrong, so don't nobody yell at me and be like, you know, you don't remember the page. But I think it was like page 38, 39 or something like that in that Roland TR-505 manual. And it talked about MIDI assignment. And I was like, huh.
I think I'm on to something.
Wait a minute. This is kind of cool. So I was like, wait a minute. I can change each one of these drum pads to a different MIDI channel. I said, huh. I said, then I can change my keyboard to assign MIDI channel. I said, I can use this one drum machine to make a track and play the bass line at the same time. Because I didn't have no money to buy nothing else.
There's a related question, Louis, about the price point of the 505 versus the Roland 909.
I don't even remember what the price point was, but I remember I paid about $200 for that 505, right?
There it is.
And that 909... was hitting harder than that.
For sure.
And making $3 an hour, it wasn't happening. You know, I'm just being real.
This is your grocery store gig.
I'm working at a grocery store. I'm scrubbing the floors. I'm delivering. Listen, I was delivering groceries across the street from 29th and Vernon over there in the projects. Man, listen, I would carry 4 bags of groceries with me at the same time. And not take the elevator, because the elevators were super nasty. The steps were filled with urine and feces. But what you didn't want to do is make 2 trips. Because once they see you coming, they think you got money. They try to rob you.
Yeah.
So I learned how to carry 4 bags of groceries at one trip and deliver them bad fellas and be out.
Yep.
You know, and actually, they tip pretty good over there in the projects. I used to get like $20 tips. Going to the projects, you know, for real. It was.
This is pre DoorDash.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
But I digress. So I learned how to do that. And I was like, this is cool. So I, you know, got these weird little toy sounds and stuff and trying to make something. It wasn't working. So I said, you know what? I got more time than I got money. Let me see if I can just make some of my own sounds. So I took that bad fella with my little Radio Shack headphones, got in bed every night. And for about 6 months straight, I just worked on sounds. I got to the point where if I wanted that bad fella to make a certain sound, I knew how to do it. I could be like, I want a sound like this. I knew exactly what waveform to use. I knew exactly where to go in my DCOs and what to port it to, and then be like, don't, man. And it was just like, it took me a long time. And then this one thing I didn't put this in the article, so this, I guess this is exclusive for you guys, but my CZ-101 had an error in it. So in some of the patterns, it had an error. Like, it was like, so the patterns would go from like 0 to 99, right?
Right.
But on some of them, they were errored out, and I would have to clear them and, you know, go ahead and make a sound again. But one time I said, you know what? This sound kind of weird. It had like a infinity sign on it instead of 99. And I said, let me try mess it around with this and see what happens. So if you listen to Computer Madness, when you get to the part where the crescendo, where, you know, when Mike Dunn did the mix,
yep,
he took the volume down and he brought it up, and it went to that crescendo part, and the sounds just started getting real crazy. That was one of them sounds where I had taken the error and used that. And so the sounds, infinity. It was almost like random. Like, it just started doing all type of random stuff.
But it worked.
But it worked. And the funny thing is, the bass line never changed. So there, the bass line sounded different because that sound was different. But the bass line never changed. And another quick fact, there are no filters on the CZ-101.
Okay.
So when you listen to Computer Madness, it sounds like I'm filtering the sounds and all that kind of stuff. I didn't have any of that equipment. But what I knew how to do was program sounds. So I programmed that CZ-101
to make it
sound like it was filtering.
Okay.
As I switched between sound and sound, because on the 505, you use the pattern play. So what does that mean? While the track is playing, you want to go to the next pattern. I would hit that pattern, and it would, on the next four beats, it would just switch.
On the four count.
So I would hit it, and then I would hook my hand over my keyboard, and then right as it was going to change to that next beat, I would, bam,
introduce.
I would change the sound. So it was real. It was a manual process.
Yep.
But because of the way I programmed the sounds, it sounded like it was phasing and filtering, that kind of thing. And I think Mr. Poindexter did some interviews saying, yeah, Wes was working on the filters, and I was working on that. And that's just not true.
We got the exclusive.
Yeah, I mean,
clarity here.
And if you don't believe me, you can Google a CZ-101, pull it up, look at it. There are no filters on a CZ-101.
So let me back up a moment just to ask, after you discovered the ability to essentially create pattern sequences, how did you get that recorded, or did you first go back and just make sure you got the kind of sounds that you were after?
So what happened was, like I said, it took me 6 months to come up with these crazy weird sounds that I thought nobody would like. Honest to God, I really didn't think anybody liked these sounds, but they were different. And so I was like, well, you know, and I was trying to really emulate my heroes, which was Future, you know, and, you know, rest in peace, Spanky, Herb J, and DJ Pierre. You know, they made acid tracks, and to me, that was like one of the most like revolutionary tracks to come out of Chicago. Like, just the drum pattern, the way it built, and then, you know, when the acid track came in and the way it just kind of eased in, and then they started following the rhythm, and just it was amazing. So I didn't have that, right? So I didn't even know what they used to make it, I ain't gonna lie. But so what I decided to do was take these weird sounds that I had and just change them. You know, just keep changing the sounds. You know, I was like, I'm gonna just keep changing the sounds. Like, it's an acid track. You know, that was my, so Computer Madness was my version of acid tracks without having a TB-303.
Okay.
Yeah.
That is an intricate story about how you created, how you discovered the sounds. I want to move into what you did with the work product. And or what somebody did with the work product.
So, okay, I'll go into that. So I bought a Yamaha 4-track, which I still have, by the way, and I use that to record Computer Madness. I also use it to record Work That Motherfucker as well. But I used a drum machine that was owned by a guy named Garen Vaughn. So Garen Vaughn was the owner of that drum machine. But, you know, he was a great DJ and all of that. And he was starting to get into making tracks. But, you know, like, I had a little studio. You know what I'm saying? I had...
Where were you?
In my basement. In my basement. Right. You know. Okay.
Tell it. And, tell it all. Don't skip on the details.
And, you know, who's got... I don't even know if I say this man's name, but he's my main man, 50 grand. The one brother who can tell you what my studio looked like probably better than anybody else in the world except for me is Terry Hunter. That man's memory is unfreaking believable. He described my studio to me like he was standing there with me like last year. Yeah.
Shout out to Terry Hunter out in LA right now waiting on
Shout out to Terry Hunter about to get that Grammy.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And we speaking that into existence.
For sure.
So I had a little small, like, so in my basement, we had basically two storage rooms, right? So the left side was like storage, and we had a door to get in there. And the right side, I made a little makeshift studio. I just brought a table in there.
Yep.
It already had like a little shelf. I put like my reel-to-reel over to the left side. I put some speakers on the right side. And I had one speaker on the floor that wasn't even being used. I used to put like that drum machine on that.
Dude, it's...
And
a little
stand. The RG1. Yeah, I used the speakers to stand. It wasn't working. You know, I blew out, so I could use it for something, right? And and at that point, I'd had my house broken into a few times, and we got some insurance money, so I actually got some 12s. So I had two 12s, little mixer, you know what I'm saying?
And I had my studio was growing up,
right? And I had my CZ-101 sitting on top of them 12s. So you know, you keep the case is down.
Dust cover,
The dust covers, and boom, it sat right in the middle. And that's where the keyboard was. Then I had the 505 over to the left side of the keyboard. And then I had my 4-track over to the right side. And actually, I used to put the 4-track on the speaker until I got my boy's RZ1 or whatever like that. And that's what I would use to record. But you know, it was cool back in the day. I wasn't really part of everybody else who was really making music back then. You know, like it was like me and Steve was just like a team, and we was gonna do this stuff together. And you know, man, I looked up to that brother. Like I really looked up. I mean, he's a charismatic guy. Like he's really like, if you've ever met him and you talk to him, it's like, man, you know, you can't help but like him.
So, and the like aside,
right?
The business again, I bring to bear here. How did you first become aware that credit for the track was not appropriately allotted and assigned to you?
So,
what happened? You put in a lot of work, clearly.
Right. So, what happened was
to do this.
You know, the track was released, you know, and he actually gave me a test press. You know, of course, as a DJ, I wanted two test presses.
Yeah.
I'm like, you know, these are my records and your records because we're supposed to be doing a 50-50 thing. And he's like, nah, you can't get two test presses. You only get one. I got to give them out to other DJs. I said, dude, this is my record, too. Like, I can't get two test presses? That's crazy. I should have known then, man. I should have known then, man. Dude, I should have known then, bro. You know, but, you know, he already had taken my 4-track to when he told me Mike Dunn's house to get it mastered or whatever, Westbrook Studios or whoever. And and he returned my 4-track. It took him like a month almost to return my 4-track. That's another thing I didn't put in the article, but it took him a long time. I was really upset about that because I didn't have money to buy another four track. You know, I'm making three bucks an hour.
Yep.
You know what I'm saying? This was a big deal to me.
And this is still, you're 16.
Like 16, 17. Right. Now. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
I'm in my car.
High school.
Right. High school. I didn't have that type of money. So he finally brought it back. He just gave me my backpack. And I was so happy. I opened it up. I saw the four track in there. I was like, oh, thank God. So I zipped it up and, you know, whatever. And he was like, man, I heard you told people, man, that, you know, you may work that and you made Computer Madness. I said, I did. He was like, man, you shouldn't be doing that, man. And I'm like, look, we said we're going to split the credit 50-50, but, you know I made these tracks. Like,
there was there still charisma in
play? Nah, wasn't no charisma no more, man.
Okay.
Yeah, because I think at the time he had like a little white Nissan Sentra. He had just got it too because they were giving them bad fellas away, man. They weren't even checking credit back then. And I don't even think he put oil change that car. He drove that car to death, man. But he pulled up his little Nissan Sentra.
Yeah. Because
the whole time I knew him, he never had a car.
Okay.
You know, so he had got a car right as the test presses was coming out and stuff like that.
In this process.
Right.
Okay.
And so then, you know, I was trying to contact him after I got the four track back and all that. And he wouldn't answer my calls. You know, I don't know, like, what happened. And so I was like, man, you know, he just disappeared. And I was like, all right. So I never saw him again. And then one day, I think I was at some record store. I don't even know which one. And it wasn't even at the Plaza. I think I was like at some suburban record store. And I saw my record, you know, Steve Poindexter, Computer Madness, Work That Motherfucker, you know, Chilling With The P. What's that? Because I didn't know what he was going to name that song. And then, okay.
But that was still one of the songs you all worked on jointly.
Right. Okay. Right. And he had very little input. Man, it was anyway. And then I found out talking to Mike Dunn that song was actually supposed to be the one that had the acid track in it because I went to California with Roy Davis Jr. and Mike Dunn, they spun at a club called Rhonda. So while we were there, we were talking about it. And Mike said, yeah. He said, I did that. The acid track was supposed to be called Chilling With The P. Because he said, because I was chilling with the P. Right? So that track was supposed to be called Chilling With The P. But, you know, when you send it to the presser and all that, they don't care. They just boop, boop. They flipped it around, mess it up or whatever. And so that's what happened with that. But yeah, after that, he was ghost. So
just want to pause a moment because Garen Vaughn checked in. He said, what's up, bro?
What's up, Garen?
With Joseph Thomas.
Okay. That's what's up.
D. McCoy is in the building.
Okay.
Leukemia People.
Okay.
Don't know. But thanks for tuning. Okay. Yeah, thanks for tuning in along with Scott Lee and Shyrock 232.
Oh, it's my brother. That's Kirk. What's up, Kirk? Kirk was there when I was doing all this stuff.
They are expressing deep appreciation for you sharing this story. So go ahead and continue. Yeah.
So I forgot exactly where I was at. So when he he went ghost. He went ghost. So Garen had a cousin that was an attorney, right? And so once I found out that he had stolen my music, I went to his cousin. And Garen hooked me up with him and was like, man, you know, help my boy out. And since that was his cousin, you know, he helped me out. He didn't charge me nothing.
Okay.
But he did some phone calls and looking around. And he came back after, like, man, like a month. Like, he was like, man, this is on an underground label. He said it's not like a real label. Like, they just pressing the stuff up and sending it out. Like, it's not. He was like, man, I don't really know what I can do about this, you know. And then remember, it was so early on. The record hadn't done nothing. You know what I'm saying?
It hadn't really created the buzz.
It hadn't done anything. It was, you know, people liked it and people starting to buy it. It was
Chicago vibe.
Right.
Initially.
Right. Yeah. And the weird thing is, I didn't find out the record started doing anything until like 2013. So I never knew. Like, I knew people liked it, worked that much, you know, like that kind of stuff. And Computer Man, they'd be like, doo 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 doo, you know. But I was like, I heard Computer Madness play on the radio a few times, stuff like that. But I didn't know it was like a big deal. So my cousin, Desiree Bolin, she's married to Thomas Bolin. So at the time, he owned a warehouse, a big 10,000 square foot warehouse out in the suburbs, you know, in Dalton. And he wanted to do a party. So he said, hey, cuz, I want you to come out, man, because you're in the house music. And I want you to, you know, help me, you know, talk to these house guys and negotiate all that.
Yep.
I was like, cool, cool. So I came out and I walked in the room. And to my surprise, Steve Poindexter was sitting in the room, you know, along with Roy Davis Jr., J.R. Jordan, and another guy named Ellery Coles. And there was like a few other people there, like from the business side on Thomas's side, my cousin Thomas's side.
It was a room.
And right. And so I walked in
some people
and I looked at Steve and I was kind of floored, like
taking the back.
Right, yeah. So I walked over to him on his left side and I put my right hand on his left shoulder and he looked up at me. And he looked back down. He looked up at me. He stood up. He threw his hands up. He said, this is the guy. This is the guy. And so everybody was like, this is what guy? What are you talking about? He said, you know, this is the guy. He helped me make those tracks. So Roy said, like in a real low, calm voice. Like, I didn't even know who he was at the time. I didn't know he was Roy Davis Jr., right?
Right.
But he said, Steven, what tracks are you referring to? He said it just like that. I swear to God, he said it just like that. And
check in with us, Roy.
Right. And did he check in?
Not yet.
But I was supposed to text him, but I didn't. But anyway, so he said, you know, my first EP, Computer Madness, worked that motherfucker, all that. So I said, Steve, I don't want to curse on the radio. I said, those are my effing tracks. And Steve just put his head down and was like, ugh. And so then,
no dispute, no acknowledgement of your statement.
None.
No, nothing.
None. And so at that point, Roy Davis Jr. asked me to step out and he wanted to have a talk with me. And I was like, you know, I didn't know who he was. He said, I'm Roy Davis Jr. He said, it's an honor to meet you, Mr. Green. And I said, who? You're Roy Davis Jr.? I said, oh, my God. It's like, you're Mr. Papapadeo, you know. And so I was, man, I was like excited, like to meet him.
Fanboying.
Right?
Yeah.
Right. I'm like, man, this dude, he's that dude. Right. You know. And so I was like, well, Mr. Davis, it's an honor to meet you. And, I said, why you say it's an honor to meet me? He said, cause you made Computer Madness and worked that motherfucker, right? I said, yeah, but those songs wasn't nothing. Nobody, you know, nobody, they played them a little bit on the radio, but that was it. He said, oh my God. You really don't know. I said, don't know what? He said, man, listen. I got 384 published tracks right now. He said, I done had tracks that sold over 50,000 copies. I done had tracks that sold over 100,000. He said, man, you add up all my tracks, my whole catalog together. Computer Madness by itself, I sold them all. Work that outsold word all by themselves individually. I said, I can't say what I said. I was like, get your. He was like, man, can I have your number, sir? I said, yeah, you know, you got my number. Roy called me up.
Yes.
He got me on the phone with Jeff Craven from Large Records.
Large, yep.
And Jeff went online and started pulling up, like, just the publishing deals, I guess, you know, because he wasn't going to never see, like, how many records were sold. You know, they were doing P&D deals. That Ray Barney, I think, was pushing that stuff out back then. And who knows who else was bootlegging that stuff, too.
For those tuned in that may not know, P&D, pressing and distribution deals.
Right, right, a press and distribution deal. So he just started looking the stuff up. And his voice kind of got, like, shaky. And he was like, oh, my God, man. These records have sold a lot, like, just in licensing deals. And he was like, wow. And I was like, what do you mean? Like, what's, you know.
You were not in tune with what was happening from a business standpoint because you were a creative, right?
And
that was your focus.
He was like, one licensing deal was 800,000 sold. Another licensing deal was 700,000 sold. Another licensing deal was 600,000 sold. Another licensing deal was 500,000 sold. Another licensing deal was like almost 500,000 sold. He just kept reading, and then I literally think he started to, like, choke up a little bit. And I was like, and I felt a little bit dizzy. I was like, wait a minute. This didn't happen. Like, that's not true. You know,
right,
nobody,
you weren't
nobody,
seeing.
Nobody like my little music like that, you know. And it was true.
So one of the questions that's come in from our audience, wasn't there any music auditing? There are actually publishing companies, is the question, that would have been involved in this, like ASCAP or BMI. And did you have membership? Did you have a writer's membership to ASCAP or BMI? No. Right?
Heck no. I didn't have no membership in ASCAP or BMI.
Thanks for that question,
Scott.
I
was 16 and I didn't know nothing about that. Man, listen, my mom was like, I was trying to get her to let me go to the studio with Steve so that we could get the stuff put on DAT. And I said, Mama, if I don't go, he might steal my music.
Yeah.
And she said, that bumpity bump stuff ain't going to make no money. Take your butt to bed. You got to go tomorrow. Carmel tomorrow. Nobody care about this bumpity bump crap.
Man, you pushing them big
and caravan I was like,
hard tonight.
Man, so, you know, I mean, I never, you know, I tried to do like a poor man's copyright. So I took like a cassette, put it in an envelope, mailed it back to myself, and thought maybe I could protect myself like that. But as I found out later, they said that's not enforceable in court and all that kind of stuff. And, I just went away to college, man, and, you know, got into IT. And I've been very blessed. God has blessed me like 10,000 fold, man. Like, he's just blessed me. It's too much stuff to talk about, man. Like, I had type 2 diabetes, reversed it. My A1C is like 4.2. You know, I lost 65 pounds. I had sciatic nerve pain so bad that I had to pray to God for help because the pain was so enormous. Like, I didn't know what I was going to do.
God is good all the time,
and,
bro.
And, you know, and at that moment, he took my pain, and I got an inversion tape. I've had a lot of stuff I went through, man, and God's been with me the whole way. And I believe that God's the one that wanted me to get my rights back, man. You know.
That's powerful that you brought your spiritual dimension to this pursuit, because, you know, again, this is it could be boiled down to a business transaction. And as we know, here in Chicago, in the earliest days of both house music and gospel and R&B, right, we weren't always up on the mechanisms, right, for getting our due credit and proper compensation for our creative product and craft. And so this is a unique story, because the next phase of it is that this ultimately led to a credit dispute that you pursued and you engaged bunch of people. Talk about
what
that process was.
You know, that night, when I saw Steve, you know, he tried to convince me to work with him again. He's like, Wes, man, we can do it again, man. We can do it again. Come on, Wes, man. We can do it again, man. I said, Steve, do what again? I never received a dime for all this stuff. He said, Wes, I ain't making no money on that either. I can show you emails right now. I make no money, man. No money. I promise you. I can show you the emails. But, man, Wes, we can do it again.
The mechanical rights, for sure, there was some connection.
He made a lot of money, bro.
Whenever that vinyl, those orders for distribution.
Man, computer madness is in video games and TV shows, movies. Like, it's, you know, it's everything. It's everywhere. But in 2022, Work That was named out of the top 200 dance tracks of all time by Rolling Stone, number 66. Like, this isn't just some track, you know, these aren't just some tracks. These are iconic tracks that help solidify the foundation of house music in Chicago.
No doubt. And you've got many, many tuned in from the house community. Want to shout out DJ Randall Dean.
What's up, Randall?
Rasool,
You know, was an integral part too. He really pushed me, man, to, you know, get my rights back.
Great friend of the show.
And, you know, he was like, man, Wes, you know, you got PTSD, man, but you got to let it go, baby. You got to let it go, man. And yeah, he was very instrumental, man.
Shannon Sias and Steve Hurley, the SNS crew.
Shannon and Steve, what's up?
Checking in. Rhonda Flowers,
what's up? Yeah, and
Scott Lee.
Rhonda, actually, and Rasool did a party in Amsterdam, like, in 2019.
ADE,
yeah. And I think next year we'll probably do another one. So, but anyway, going back to the story, so I forgot exactly where I was at.
We were talking about the fact that you came to this realization that,
right,
and then you recognized the need to dispute
exactly
what had happened.
So that night I talked to Steve. I was like, look, man, I just want my name on my publishing. You know what I'm saying? Like, just add my name to the publishing or whatever like that. So I didn't know at the time, Steve had also talked to him. I mean, Roy Davis Jr.
Roy had talked to Steve.
And said, look, man, you don't make this right with Wes, I'm going to tell everybody in the house music community to not mess with you at all. So after that, Steve went and did an article in Resident Advisor.
All right,
man. It's called That Raw Basement Sound. If you go read that, he talks about me. Yeah, this guy named Wes. He had a studio. He helped me make these tracks and all that. So at least he talked about me. He said that I was a person and that I had a studio and I worked on the music. But he still alleged that he did all this stuff, right?
Okay.
I worked with him, tried to get them to. He's like, man, those tracks old, man. Those tracks old. I give you publishing on my new stuff. I said, Steve, I don't want publishing on your music. I just want publishing this mine. Like, I don't want nothing you did. I could care less about that stuff. And I mean, and I have a challenge to any DJ out there. Any DJ. Name me 3 songs that Steve Poindexter did without naming Computer Madness, Work That Motherfucker, Chilling with the P, or Whiplash. I'll wait. Anyway, so
comments are coming in.
Yeah, I bet. And I said 2 because most people can name Short Circuit, right? But outside of that, you know, I don't know. And you can't say Bessie Smith because that was Gene Hunt's track. That wasn't his. But anyway, so, and you can call Gene on that. Ask him if you want to. Just total facts.
So you had to move forward by taking legal action.
So I tried to work with him. He wouldn't work with me. So I got a law firm called Citigroup out of the UK and an attorney named Raymond Croker. And
why the UK? Just out of curiosity.
Because they specialize in those type of things,
and it was a global publishing issue.
Exactly. So like they went up against like Warner Chappell, Sony Music. Like, in fact, their company doesn't normally take a case like mine, like me, yeah. Okay. And but when he, I was introduced to him by a dear friend, and when he heard my story, and he went and did research to find out if it was true, right? Because he was like, I'm not just going to take this case if it's not true. He came back to me and said he would take my case. And I didn't know he did all this research. And I said, well, you know, do you want to know, like, what happened all day? He said, I already know what happened. I did my research. You know, I verified that your story is true. And I'm going to take your case. And he said, because we need to right a wrong. And I just couldn't believe it. And they were amazing. Like, the law firm was amazing. And, you know, they helped me get my rights to my publishing back. And, yeah.
Wow.
And it took over a year. Yeah.
So the law firm, that was certainly the right choice to affect the outcome that you got. You also had friends that were, I'm assuming, just personal friends. But talk a little bit about the rest of the Chicago music community. You made reference to Roy Davis Jr.'s influence in this issue.
He's very influential in this whole thing. None of this probably would have happened without him. This man called me once a day for 6 months straight. I don't know if anybody knows, like, people like him, or, you know, like Shannon, Steve, Maurice Joshua, Terry Hunter, anybody, like, you know, not to say they're all on the same level, but I'm saying people are really serious about their craft.
Yes.
They don't call people every day, and they will not answer your call every day.
Fair.
If you don't believe me, just try it. Like, try to call. If you've got Steve Hurley's number, try to call him right now. See if he answers. He's not going to answer because he's busy. He's a professional. He has to make his money and do his thing. He cannot answer your call.
We are all grinding for sure.
Roy Davis Jr., he's a professional. He cannot take your call every day. Maurice Joshua, he's a professional. He's not going to take your call every day. You know, Terry Hunter. None of these people are going to take your calls every day. People who, this is what they really do for a living, they don't have that type of time.
Well, I got a caveat that they do generally pick up for the Vintage House Show, just a shout out.
If you call them 3 or 4 times in a week, you will not get that phone call answered every time. I almost guarantee you.
We get a good call back rate.
They call you back. Yeah. They're gonna answer it every day.
But your point is well made.
Right.
And the that community to rally around you really says a lot.
Yeah.
It says a whole lot.
And I really didn't talk to people about it that much when I was coming up, because it was like, who was going to believe me? You know, it was like, now when I was in school at Mount Carmel, you know, they knew I made these tracks, you know.
Oh, your classmates.
My classmates knew I made it. Right.
Right.
You know, I gave Terry Hunter the first tape to play Work That at the Bismarck.
Okay.
And, you know, next time you talk to Terry Hunter, ask him about the story. But he played Work That at the Bismarck, and I swear to God, I thought the floor was going to cave in. Them kids started going crazy.
Yeah.
I literally walked off the dance floor and stood in the doorway, knowing that the doorway was reinforced and was stronger than just standing on the floor
in the middle of the dance floor.
Because I didn't want the dance floor to cave in and I fall with it. You know what I'm saying? So I backed up. And Terry told me some years ago when he played it that they went crazy, and he said, I didn't even know how to get out of the track. Yep.
That's a great story. So we're certainly in just immersed in this story, and we weaved our way through a lot of it. But with 5 minutes left for this episode of Vintage House, I want to ask you a very important question, and that is, what, if any, changes have you seen occur in not just your story, but from a collaboration standpoint in Chicago? Do you feel that it is truly now a community of of sharing, of equal participation and equity? Or do you think that there's still instances of this kind of misdirection and misuse of someone's intellectual property going on?
Oh my God. Listen, you're not about to get everybody hating me on this, bad fella. I mean, the reality is, you already know the answer to that. You know, somebody will rob you going to your car, man. You think they won't take your music? I could tell you a million stories that I know to be a fact. There's some people on the chat right now that could tell you some of the stories, stuff that happened to them. I'm not going to name no names. But, you know, stuff happens, man. And it's not about what happens to you. It's what you do about it, you know. And it's not always easy to stand up, you know. And it's not cheap to stand up either. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, in order to make all this stuff happen, you know, you're going to have to, you know, have some money. You're going to have to be able to hire the right people. And it's not easy, you know. But again, I've been blessed, you know. And God put me in a position where I could, you know, handle this.
And there's no question. I appreciate your, again, the spiritual dimension from which you tell the story and give the appreciation and, of course, grace and praise from where it all comes from and stems from. I think you've also, though, individually empowered people that have listened and read about this story, and they're going to stand up because of Louis West Green.
Yeah.
How does that make you feel?
That makes me feel great, man. And I've actually reached out to people that I know that have had their music taken and told them, you know, if they need help, I would try to put them in touch with the right people, help them. You know, there's some specific people I reached out to recently. Like, but, you know, it's hard, man. People, they're unsure and they don't know what to do. And it's tough, man. It's tough to stand up because people look at you different, you know. And everybody's like, oh, man, it's been almost 40 years. Why you wait 40 years to try to get your rights to your music back? I didn't wait 40 years to get the rights to my music back. I tried to get the rights to my music back right away.
It was a journey.
It was a journey.
Yeah. And certainly resilience, determination are all characteristics that were important to have in this journey. I certainly want to thank you for taking the time for Chicago's community to come on the Vintage House Show and to tell the story. But it wouldn't be an ending that would be appropriate without learning what is next for Wes Green.
Well, what's next? I've got a new EP coming out called My First Computer. I've got a track on there that I went back to my old school CZ-101, spent a year making sounds again, and put that together. I actually redid Computer Madness, went back, reprogrammed all my original sounds, the ones that I could do. Some of them is just, you know, I did the best I could. But I've got a new version of that that, unfortunately, one of my good friends has said he wouldn't send it to nobody, send it out to a bunch of people. And I even heard DJ Alicia playing it in one of her mixes live, you know, which was cool. You know, she didn't know. She just got a WeTransfer with the files. It was like, man, this is dope. But yeah, so I got a few things happening. And in March 23rd, I believe, the new EP drops. And yeah, so it's... Hopefully people enjoy it.
So we were prepared to try to play a little snippet.
Okay.
Tonight I'm not seeing the next show host coming up. So if you bear with us, we'll certainly try to drop.
Go for it.
An exclusive premiere of My First Computer.
Okay.
Wes Green. I want to certainly reach out to everybody that checked in, DJ Purple, again, Rasul, Randall Dean, Rhonda Flowers, SNS, our in-studio crew, of course, shout out to the executive producer of the Vintage House Show, Miss Lauren Lowry, my co-host.
Lauren Lowry. And she was very instrumental in this, too, because when she interviewed Mr. Poindexter on her show, she actually got him to admit that my name was on the record when it was first pressed, which is probably a shocker to most of you guys listening.
There is. I'm glad you did that, because surely we have that interview and recording, but you were telling the story in such an engaging way. I did not get to drop that one.
And he admitted that I actually made, you know, the bass line for Computer Madness. He alleged he made the track. If you guys heard the track, you know, come on, stop it. You know, he did the snare drum intro, and he named it. That's all that he did with Computer Madness. And work that, it was my track. It was his sample voice. And, you know, we changed the hi-hats. And if you think about his story, it makes sense, right? If he said in his interview that he had me change the hi-hats for him because he couldn't do it, then that means the hi-hats were already programmed. So the track was already programmed. You know, Garen Vaughn was there. His brother, his cousin John was there. My brother was there. He came in my studio and said, hey, let's make a track called Work That Motherfucker. And I said, okay. I said, well, here's a tribal track. Let's do it. And he was like, cool. And then I maybe walked out the studio for a minute, came back, and all he did was start sliding the drums. Volume controls up and down to hear the different patterns. He was like, yeah, this is dope. And he gonna try to take credit for the track? It was ridiculous.
So we've got that video clip. We're gonna try to play that as well as the new release coming out March 23rd, 2024, My First Computer. And we want to thank Louis Westgreen for being in studio here at WNUR 89.3 FM and HD1 in Evanston, Chicago, on this episode of The Vintage House Show with your main man, Mega. Of course, The Vintage House Show is every Wednesday night, 10 p.m. Central, right here on 89.3 on Facebook Live, on Twitch.tv, The Vintage House Show, and everywhere you enjoy your favorite podcast. And, of course, we got a new episode dropping this week. I'm looking for my executive producer to let me know when that's going to drop. But we are going to play a segment of the interview that Lauren Lowry had with Steve Poindexter, and you can hear for yourself.
And then you're like, we're going to record that. That's hot, and we're going to record it. What's going on for Work That Motherfucker?
Okay. That was done at a friend's house. It stayed on Chappelle, which is Louis Green.
He's a friend of the show. He's been on.
Yeah. Louis had a studio. I had a studio, but my studio was in my mother's front room on the floor. I would put my headphones on at night and make tracks. So before that album came out, I had the Short Circuit album out. Then I had something on Gherkin. And then me and Louis looked up, and I made Work That over his house. And I got the two guys named, they brought their drum over, which was a Calcio drum. And Louis and I was, you know, producing music for other people. And Louis said, hey, they wants to make some beats for them. So we had done some stuff for them. And then Gary, one of them name was Gary. And they went upstairs, and I was like, before they went up, I said, are y'all finished? You know, I take this and do something. They're like, yeah, go ahead. So I put the track together for Work That. But I couldn't get my hi-hat pattern the way I wanted to. Just couldn't get my hand right. So I had Louis to help me on it. And then I sampled my trademark, which is Work That. Because there was a mistake when I was trying to make the track while it's upstairs, something happened. And I was like, this mother, and I went on and just, you know, I'm like, whoa. And I just came out with the name, Work That. Because I'm thinking about music, and the way the track is hidden, it's a party track. And then a few days later, we went back to Louis' house. He had a Casio keyboard, a four-track recorder, and he had programmed some sounds into the keyboard. Louis was making tracks too. Like, well, I'll go over there, he would let me get some of the stuff that he was making, and then we would come together and do some things. Some of the bass lines that he had programmed, I asked him, I said, Louis, are you going to use these bass lines? And he's like, not really, you want to do something with them? I made a track, which is Computer Madness. And I was like, let's do the bass lines on top of this. So we programmed it, put it together, and I just started changing the keys, and he started changing and moving the filters on it. And that's how Computer Madness came out. I used his bass lines, some of the stuff that he had programmed, and then I had programmed some of them. And that's what Computer Madness came out in. And the first go-round for keyboard and stuff and on producing, the first records came out, had Louis' name on it. But the label was owned by Armando. When the second batch came out, Louis' name wasn't on it for the Computer Madness playing the boards. So before that, the other two tracks on the back side, I had done the third track at Louis' house, which was Born to Free. And Chilling with the People. Yeah, Chilling with the People. I'm sorry. Yeah, Born to Free and Chilling with the People. But I went to Armando, Mike Dunn, and Marshall Jefferson and Bam Bam Studio, Westbrook Studio. And I was over there and we were recording the track. And Mike walked into the room and he hit the bassline machine. That's why you hear a track playing one bassline, and then when he comes back, he's got another bassline. It actually went into one of Mike's basslines, and we didn't want to stop the recording, so he's like, go ahead, keep on going. And we brought it back into the original bassline. It was an accident, but it done what it did.
Thanks for listening to the Vintage House Show podcast. Please subscribe and share and check us out live, WNUR 89.3 FM, Wednesdays at 10 o'clock.